The third meeting of the Subcommittee on Child Care Access and Affordability will come to order. So we do have a quorum present. And do I have a motion to approve the chair represent or the minutes from January 18th, Representative Albright? Thank you. Representative Albright moves the approval of the minutes from January 18th. Does anybody have any additions, corrections, or changes today? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right, those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes from January 18th are approved. All right, so today we are going to continue the DHS's presentation of the Federal Child Care and Development Block Grant. Thank you for coming back to the committee. They are going to present information, and we had some questions from the last time we were following up with this that they are going to be answering as well. So thank you for attending, Nikki and Regina. Welcome to the committee. And if you want to please state your name and title for whoever's going to go first for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Nikki Farrago. I am the Deputy Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. Thank you again for having us back here. It's another snowy morning. It seems like every time we're here, we get a fun commute in. I think it's like a time management test for me. But we do appreciate the opportunity to be back here to continue to talk with you about our child care program and the federal reauthorization. So when we were last here, Assistant Commissioner Jim Koppel provided an overview of what's required under federal reauthorization. And during that overview, we had some questions come up, some specific requests from members. So we're back here today to give you that information and to go into that detail a little bit for you. So I'm planning to address those questions with any additional information. You have a packet with some handouts. Some of the handouts are just for reference, and some will be going through, and I'll make note of that as I go through my testimony. So the first thing you should have is titled Child Care Assistance Program, Caseload by County. It's just a table. So this is from our DHS data warehouse and just gives you a look of, based on the county, how many cases we have, cases and families is how we talk about it, and then how many children we have in each county. So that's just for your reference. The next document in your packet is called FAQs, Child Care Assistance Program Market Survey and Maximum Rates. There was a lot of discussion last time on our rates, and so we put this document together to assist in talking about that, and I'm going to go through this one in more detail. So we do a child care market rate survey every 2 years. I believe Representative Albright had some questions about how we do that and what that looks like. So we gather the prices that are charged, some fees that are charged, and also providers' willingness to care for children that are receiving CCAP, and some additional information as well that we use on our parentaware.org website. So most recently, we had our market rate surveys done in 2014 and 2016. Surveys, as you can see, they take several months to complete. We most recently started in January 2016, and it was May 2016 before we finished. We included 9,000 licensed family child care providers and 1,600 centers in that survey. We got about 65% of licensed providers that responded to the market rate survey. And our current proposal updates rates to this 2016 survey. The results of the market rate surveys are available. They're posted on our public website. They are a public report. And just to note that the report is are results of the survey. They are not the rates themselves. So you do have, you should have behind the FAQ a document that looks like this. This is the market rate survey for 2014. And this is our most recently published one. We have, like I said, completed the survey for 2016, but we are still doing analysis on the report, so that report is not out yet. It will be soon, and once it is out, it will be posted, and we're happy to share that with the committee. So getting back into a little back into the maximum reimbursement rates for CCAP, the current ones went into effect on February 3rd of 2014, and they're set at the 25th percentile. Do maximum rates vary? Yes. And that's a very big yes, because as we mentioned last time, there are over 2,000 rates. There are specifically 2,088 different rates, and that is because we have a rate for based on geographic location. It's based on the type of provider, whether you're family child care, center care. It's based on the age of the child that you're serving. And then, as we mentioned last time, there are those quality rate differentials that you can get for being a 3 or 4 star rated parent aware. So what is the 25th percentile? Madam Chair, I know last time you asked for kind of a layman's explanation of the 25th percentile. And so if you think about the rates, if you took the rates for a particular provider set and a particular age in a particular area, and you line them all up, the one from the, if you started at the bottom and come up a quarter of the way, that's the 25th percentile. And then you do that for each group. So you do that 2,000 sometimes based on, again, the type of provider, the age of the child, the location. And if you do want to see all of our maximum rates, they are posted on our DHS website, both the standard rates and our quality differential rates that we have posted. We have additional information in the document about whether prices are fully covered. And we do have about 30% of provider prices that are fully covered under our current maximum rates. There was also a question about if the maximum rates are set at this 25th percentile, how can the percent of prices fully covered be greater than 25%? And there's different reasons for this. Some are, a lot of providers have the same rates. They charge right about the same based on local competition and things like that. So that affects it. And then there are some rates that when the latest market rate survey came into effect, they were already higher than the 25th percentile. So those rates were not decreased. They would have stayed where they were and wouldn't have changed. The next piece we have about how can prices go down? Aren't providers increasing their prices to offset increasing expenses? So our market rate survey also does reveal some fluctuation in the provider prices. There are different reasons why it might go down. Sometimes we have different providers that are responding. We do try to get as many providers to respond as possible. However, there might be one provider that responds 1 year and doesn't the next year, or new providers that are coming in that are responding. We also have changes in local economy and families that might be in the local area. Lastly, how do provider prices impact the maximum rates that CCAP can pay? So provider prices are gathered in the survey are used by the legislature as a factor in setting the new maximum rates. So that's how they can, this committee and the legislature can impact the maximum rates. And then one example, there was a question about how rural Minnesota is comparing with rates to the metro. We do have an example, some weekly rates for some preliminary analysis out of our most recent survey shows that weekly rates in the metro will increase under our proposal 5.5%. Outside of the metro, it will increase 6.6%. That's for family child care.
Ms. Warner, I have a couple of questions. Representative Albright.
Ms. Warner, it's early and I haven't had enough coffee.
Oh, sorry.
But in light of what you just described, and please understand I'm not trying to be trite, cute, or snarky, but do you understand how these rates are established?
Yes, I do. Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I do have a basic understanding of how we do get to the rates. We do contract with a vendor to actually set the rates. They take the data that we get from the survey. They put it into the software program that they use that I'm not sure what that one is, but to establish all of those 2,000 and such rates.
Madam Chair and Ms. Warner, that's to my point. We have 2,088, give or take, rates. How can anyone plausibly fathom how to be as effective as possible with that many rate structures?
Madam Chair, Representative, do you mean the, could you clarify the, how can the provider be effective?
I'm happy to. You described literally an algorithm that the department goes through in terms of putting these rates together. And when I asked you the first question in terms of if you understood those, my follow-up is actually how many people within the department truly do understand how these rates are computated and calculated? And it sounds like maybe a handful. And so if that's the case, how can providers legitimately lay claim to the fact or to the notion that they would truly understand how they could be reimbursed most effectively if there's 2,088 rates? That's akin to buying a lottery ticket every Wednesday and hoping you win. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, she doesn't need an answer, but I hope she does.
Madam Chair, Representative, and thank you for that. You know, we are very aware of the complexities in the program. What I will say is the market survey that we conduct does give providers that opportunity to give their input on what their rates are and how they're best serving their community and how they're best running their business. And that input, along with how we do our business and how the legislature chooses to set the maximum rates, is how we get there. I'm not going to tell you that it's easy to understand, because it's not.
Madam Chair, I just have one follow-up for the Ms. Warner, but what would be the contemplation of simplifying this to, say, a dozen rates based upon geographic districts? Has there ever been a study or contemplation to say, this is insane, 2,088 rates? That's akin to having a different rate or a different price for gas at every gas station you go into in the state of Minnesota or the metropolitan area. Based upon the community you live in, you might pay for a different price for gas. So why are we making it so complicated for providers that they have to jump through hoops when legitimately all they care about is taking care of kids?
representative, Madam Chair, representative, I don't know that we have looked into studying that issue before. I'm looking over at my staff to see if we have. Okay, we have. And we haven't yet, so I'm going to assume that it's for a good reason. I can follow up with you on that.
I think the committee would benefit from that contemplation just for going to the rest of the session, appreciating, truly appreciating what providers need to struggle with on a daily basis in terms of making sure that they operate their businesses and keep their head afloat. So I look forward to that in committee, Madam Chair, and that's all I have.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And looking at the materials provided, and, you know, frankly, you know, you say licensed family child care, licensed child care center providers, during the unionization effort, it seemed as if half of the, well, the licensed providers were about two-thirds of the people that were contacted in regards to unionization that had received the funds. But it seemed as if a third of them were unlicensed. Now, if that mix is representative of the providers, then why are you handing us a summary that says it's only the licensed providers that you use for the, you know, all these data points and all this information, if a third of the providers in this program are unlicensed? That seems like a bad data set to be doing all your work from and coming to us and talking to us about the situation. Am I misreading that there actually are no unlicensed providers whatsoever that are, you know, involved in this program?
Ms. Farrell?
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, Reggie Wagner, I'm with the Office of Inspector General at DHS. I oversee the licensing division. I think I have some ballpark numbers related to what we know of some of our licensed and unlicensed providers, because the reauthorization changes do impact even those that are unlicensed that are participating in the CCAP program. And we talked a little bit at the January 11th about, you know, unlicensed care, how might that come to our attention. I think ballpark numbers, about 1,700 licensed child care centers, about 8,800 licensed family child care providers. Within both of those groups, some number participate in the child care assistance program. Approximately two-thirds maybe of centers. It's much higher for centers than for family child care providers. For family, licensed family child care providers, again, we can get to the firmer ones, but maybe closer to, say, a third. Then we have, as I mentioned previously, under the Human Services Licensing Act, there are exemptions from needing a license, and several of those do involve the care of children. So we don't always know who is providing unlicensed care. We do know, however, if you're providing unlicensed care and you want to participate in the child care assistance program, then you do need to be registered and authorized and approved at the county level for that. There are approximately 700 what we're calling license-exempt centers. So they're generally either in a school setting or in a larger community setting. They're not necessarily in the home. And then there are approximately 700 legal non-licensed, so that would be license-exempt, that are providing care to more than just their own family members. So that would be at like one or two of the same neighbor's children, let's say, and participating in the subsidy program.
Madam Chair, that's talking about confirmation that there's a large amount of providers that aren't in this survey, aren't in the data that you're referencing for making decisions. And, you know, frankly, you know, if you're going to say, well, we've got all this wonderful data, we're got this, you know, algorithm, we do all this stuff, but if you're leaving out such a large portion, that's not a trivial quantity of providers or children. And therefore, why don't you have a complete set of data that you use for this, the people, because you know who's active in this program because you were able to generate lists and send out ballots.
Well, they didn't send out ballots.
Well, okay. You sent out, generated a list for ballots to be sent out. So are you just saying we don't need that data or you don't need to look at this data? I mean, what's the justification of having this study with such a large quantity of active providers not included in your study? I mean, why should we consider this valid data without an accurate group?
Madam Chair, Representative, my name is Elizabeth Rowe. I manage the Child Care Assistance Program at the Department of Human Services. In terms of the study or the survey is a survey of licensed providers because that is the market that exists that we can identify. And so we can identify licensed providers and we can survey them of the charges that they, prices that they charge to all of the families they serve. We do not have a way to identify the entirety of the unlicensed market. We are surveying the entirety of the licensed market, both providers who serve child care assistance families and those who do not.
Madam Chair, so you're saying this survey is just the entirety, but you do have a way of identifying the people that have engaged unlicensed in this program. So you do have a way with we heard several hundred exempted centers and several hundred individual providers, so you know them. So you can't have a supplement that includes that data for reference because it is a significant quantity and portion when we're looking at the program. So ignoring and saying, well, we don't know the whole story. Well, you know the people that are active. And through history, you've had interactions with. So therefore, I would anticipate that you would have, you know, an asterisk in reference to the exempted centers and the unlicensed. Otherwise, you know, you're not giving us a complete picture. I could see if it was 5% or less than 10% of the provider's active, but it looks as if it's, you know, in the double-digit percentages, and I'm just disappointed that, you know, the data isn't available.
All right. Thank you, Representative Quam. Ms. Farrago, do you want to continue on with your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the next document that you have in your packet is labeled Child Care Assistance Program Reauthorization. And, Madam Chair, this is the cost breakout of everything that Assistant Commissioner Koppel went over at the last time. Yes. It's the chart. So this chart represents the program changes and the costs associated with those specific program changes. We broke it out by specific change. There are some themes that were highlighted last time we were here, such as going from 6 months to 12 months for redeterminations. But you have that breakout in front of you. Just a couple of areas to highlight. The changes related to our 12-month continuous eligibility, those are on That's in box 1, 2, 4, 5, and 7 on that front page. So you can see the costs there. On the second page, item 8 is related to our copays remaining the same. We had talked about copays not increasing over the 12 months until the next redetermination, and that's that item there. And then item 14 on that same page is updating the maximum rates to the 2016 market rate survey.
Ms. Farrago, on line number 1, and I guess, let's see if that, line number 1, could you explain to the committee why taking it from every 6 months to a year is going to be so costly when it's just a matter of just shifting how, you know, the amount of time it's going to take or the amount of time that the families will be on the program? So why would that cost money when we're already doing it just on a six-month basis?
Madam Chair, so the cost for this biennium is $1.8 million to make that change. And there is some fluctuation for families that can happen in that second 6 months. So right now we do redetermination after the first 6 months. There are some changes that will go into effect in those the second 6 months that we wouldn't be having families go off the program and then back on and have that ebb and flow. So there would be a cost to keeping all those families continuously on the program for the full 12 months.
Could you explain exactly what that cost is for? Like what it's going toward?
Madam Chair, that cost is for the program. It would go to pay providers for families to stay in care continuously for the 12 months. The last page is a few items that closely align with our federal requirements. And just to be frank, these are not strictly required by federal reauthorization. The numbers here are what is reflected in the governor's budget, which was released yesterday. And these are additional policy changes that the department put forward and the governor included in his budget because they closely align with the federal requirements and made sense to tie into this federal reauthorization. Do you have any questions on this document? Otherwise, I was going to move on to our last piece in the packet.
No, that's fine.
Okay. And if there are any questions from the committee as they come up.
Representative Albright has a question.
Ms. Werner, I'm looking at this, and pardon my ignorance, I'm just kind of catching up on all the nuances of this. But so I understand that CCAP may, you know, come to us in terms of a block grant in the future, or maybe it does now. Just bear with me here. So if we don't pass the federal conformity, right, so in that case, what happens to this program state on the state level if we don't align with the federal regulations?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, we could be subject to federal penalties that would impact our ability to serve families under this program at the state level.
Madam Chair. Okay, so noncompliance, right? We're talking about noncompliance. Federal penalties are enforced. What are those penalties?
Madam Chair, Representative, we don't have a clear answer from from the our federal representatives as to what a number would be for federal penalties. Right now, we do have a waiver. We were meant to comply by September of 2016. We have a waiver for that's good for a year right now to meet to comply with federal requirements by September of 2017. But we have not gotten a clear answer as to what those penalties may be if we don't comply. I believe we have, Reggie, I think in your area, one clear penalty, like a 5% penalty for licensing that might get incurred, but we don't have any other clear parameters for the penalties at this point.
If I could, Madam Chair, Representative Albright, the language talks about, in the federal reauthorization, talks about a percentage that, you know, that it can be a reduction, a penalty, but the only clear indication is a 5% reduction if we are not fully in compliance with background study requirements. There are some enhanced background study requirements that are required as part of reauthorization.
So, Madam Chair, and to both of you, so I hear that there is a penalty or a suggestion of a maximal penalty for one provision if we're not in compliance with it. But it sounds like there are a number or a host of other features that we've been provided some leniency under the waiver to approach compliance, and that's a year. And when the clock's ticking on that, so when does the clock stop on that waiver currently?
Madam Chair, Representative, that waiver is through September 30th of 2017. So that's when the clock would stop.
So, Ms. Werner, what other penalties could be exacted upon the department? What other provisions are we asking for more time to conform with?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have asked for more time that's encompassed in the current waiver. And we are moving towards compliance in time for that, before that waiver expires in September of 2017, to avoid any possible penalties incurred.
And Ms. Werner is the...
It's Ms. Virgo.
I'm sorry. I wish I had more copy. So the 5% is on top, is on the amount of the total block grant, or how is that assessed?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Madam Chair, I think Ms. Rowe might know. No, that's fine. I think, Madam Chair, Representative Albright, we are trying to get clarity from our federal officers related to this, because it isn't as clear as it is related to the background study changes. And so it's not clear, and it's not clear if it would be up to a certain amount. What would they determine as noncompliance sufficient to trigger a financial penalty? Would there be a corrective action? There is one part of our federal block grant that they did not grant a waiver for, and so we're under a corrective action plan currently for providers participating in the subsidy program to obtain health and safety training. So I think it's unclear whether they would look straight at penalties, whether we would have any opportunity for additional waivers. I think that's unclear. The final rule talks about states being fully in compliance by September 30th of 2018, but our waiver has only been approved through 2017. Some of the areas that affect licensing in the waiver have to do with meeting the annual inspection requirements. Many of the things that we talked about, we are not able to do in the licensing end without more either legislative authority or staffing. And so background studies, they would have to be a national FBI fingerprint study. We do not have authority. We have limited authority currently in our system to submit for a full FBI study. This would be required of all child care center staff and family child care providers. Doesn't necessarily change significantly who needs one, but the type of study definitely changes, and we do not have authority to implement that yet. We're also working on some system changes related to that. So the so there were several items that affected both of our areas that are encompassed in the waiver.
Well, the reason I ask the questions, Madam Chair, and for the purposes of this session, we're in the contemplation of a budget for the state of Minnesota, and if there's no clarity in terms of what that cost would be in terms of for the budget for your program in particular, how can we be fair to the people that rely upon it and or you that rely upon the code if we don't have clarity from the regulatory bodies out in Washington to identify what parameters we need to plan for over the next biennium? It seems as if we're groping in the dark for answers from Washington, and we're not getting it. And so how can we legitimately lay claim to an accuracy when we do our budgeting? So that's just an op-ed on my part.
I do have a question. We have a new administration, and I am wondering if the federal block grants will be affected if you are, you know, by the new administration. Have you heard anything? Personally, I've been trying to get a hold of some people on the federal level to ask these questions, but I really can't seem to find anybody to get a hold of right now.
Madam Chair, we haven't heard anything about the block grant being impacted negatively, positively, or whatsoever. I don't know if staff has heard anything either, but no, I'm getting a lot of no's, shaking their heads. So we haven't received any updates.
The last time we met, or was it the time before that, I did ask for some contact information of people, you know, on the federal level so that we also could reach out to them.
Madam Chair, we'll be sure to get that to you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Vice Chair Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, just in plain language, do you know how much it costs, you know, how many FTEs does it cost to implement the federal block grant program? And then, in addition, what other FTEs do our counties need to also implement it?
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm going to let Ms. Wagner talk about the FTEs. For my portion and what I've handed out to you, for the CCAP policy changes, we do not have any FTEs included here. But there are some for the department that Ms. Wagner will address in just a couple minutes. So the last piece that I have is related to Parent Aware. I know there were a couple of questions the last time we were here about Parent Aware. So you have two handouts. There's one that's titled the Minnesota's Quality Rating and Improvement System. It's just a one-pager. And then there's also a two-sided map. So the handout gives you a little better idea about what Parent Aware is, who is eligible to become a Parent Aware provider, and just so the committee is aware, it points you to you have to serve kids that are under age 5 and that use health and safety practices monitored by the department or another entity. So you can be a licensed child care center, licensed family child care, Head Start, or school-based pre-K program. There's also some information on the handout about how to earn a 3 or 4-star rating. Those are the providers that would get the rate differential. Some ways that a provider could earn a 3 or 4-star rating, an example is that they would be committed to helping children get ready for school, kindergarten readiness, using a child assessment tool and curriculum. These are the providers that use best practices in those areas. They would also be providers committed to ongoing professional development, training in areas like child development, offering healthy meals, and engaging the children that they care for in some kind of active play. And then these are the providers who also have developed strong relationships with the families that they serve. And then moving to the handout with the maps on both sides. So this provides the geographic locations of our rated providers. Just a little bit more background on Parent Aware. We do offer ratings in all 87 of our counties in Minnesota as of January 1, 2015. We had a phased rollout that occurred. So as of now, statewide, we have approximately 38% of our children that are receiving child care assistance are in high-quality settings. And that concludes my testimony for today, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Werner, did you have more to add?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we had a little bit of follow-up that you had also asked us for. We have two handouts. One I'll just acknowledge and let you know what it is. This is one that says background study requirements for licensed child care. This reflects current requirements. As I mentioned, there are some changes required, significantly doing a national criminal background check, which would involve the doing an FBI and submission. So this reflects what our current study is. I think in particular Representative Albright had a few questions after about who needs one. We're happy to follow up either as an additional hearing or in any individual conversations if you have more information about it. The other handout that I was going to just kind of guide us through in our remarks and get to Representative Peterson's questions and others regarding our FTE amount. It is this document here with our heading on it, 2014 reauthorization of the Child Care Development Block Grant, key health and safety requirements. That's kind of our framework for the licensing and background studies that are impacting us within the Office of Inspector General. On the front page with the bullets, I won't spend a lot of time because we talked about those on the 11th, but those are the key ones relating to the licensing and background study.
Ms. Werner, we have a question.
I can wait.
Okay, great.
Go ahead. Okay, thank you. On the second page, so our big thing which will impact a request for FTEs and will certainly impact the counties is probably kind of a multi-pronged and a little bit hard to separate. One is the requirement to go to annual inspections. As I've mentioned, we currently are staffed to do them at about an every two-year cycle for our child care centers. Those are DHS staff that are licensors that do those inspections. We're also required and do a inspection during the first year of any newly licensed program, but after that it's generally 2 years. The counties are also doing that initial inspection of a brand new first license child care, family child care program in the county. We have a county delegated system. Then a family child care provider is generally relicensed every 2 years. And so the county licensor would be going out as part of that renewal on a two-year cycle, doing some inspection as well as the paperwork involved in that. In our work with the counties on understanding the changes and how this would impact them, we've tried to do some surveys, gather some information, and we only had about 50 counties respond out of, of our 87, and about half of them indicated that their licensing staff go out on an off-year inspection. So that doesn't mean that all counties aren't doing it, but some are, but there's also a big swath of the counties that we don't know. So, and some counties license multiple things. Their licensors may be doing child foster care as well as family child care. So counties can be staffed differently. Some license holders hold both of those licenses. So, it's hard to kind of view the county work in just one area because the sizes and the staffing complements can vary. But clearly, just as licensing will need more staff to be able to do annual inspections, we know that this will also put a pressure on the counties to be able to do annual inspections. The federal block grant the Reauthorization Act does not mandate a caseload. It does, however, state that states are supposed to have policies and procedures in place adequate to ensure that annual inspections can be met. And then they point states to the sort of benchmark, gold standard, if you will, that some would say, from the National Child Care Aware Organization of one licensor for every 50 license holders. So somewhere within that, we have been trying to assess what our needs are. On a two-year average, our caseload for DHS licensors, it can vary, and but it's roughly about 160, 170. We're actually seeing an increase in the child care center applications. So our caseload from even a year ago is continuing to increase by about maybe 80 a year. So within a year, we're almost at the point of potentially needing yet another licensor, to, depending on the caseloads. So we have tried to factor in, you know, both current trends. As I think members know, we also have, as part of the Inspector General, a very intentional focus regarding program integrity. It's also a requirement under the federal reauthorization, program integrity. A separate unit that is housed within our fraud and financial abuse investigations has resources that are devoted to looking at provider fraud and program integrity issues. We in licensing, however, also have a responsibility to be looking at that, and we have just seen some increase in our own licensing caseload, even when we're just trying to stay focused on applications, you know, ensuring that we know who is involved in the program. So it's to say that that impacts our ability as well. When we looked at what our FTE requirements might be, we also factored in the requirement of the posting of inspection reports. I know that members have printed testimony from Cindy Cunningham, who is a licensed provider. I don't see her here and wasn't certain if she was going to testify. I know that I've had a chance to look over her comments, and it's what we have heard some providers express before. Right now, the sort of bread and butter work of a licensor at either the state or the county level is to go out at least on a regular basis. If you're not being called out and hitting a priority level for a need to go out and do an inspection because of a alleged violation, so that could trigger a visit. Allegations about maltreatment could trigger a visit. But if that program is not having anything referred to either us or the county licensor, then, as I said, it's generally a two-year cycle. We do, for child care centers, post the correction order, or if it's a conditional license terms, or even a revocation, we post all of those now on a website that DHS maintains, Licensing Information Lookup, for child care centers. For counties, we do not get the correction orders that the licensor might give to a provider. We have never gotten those. We do, however, post, receive, or part of the process of determining whether a conditional license is warranted for a family child care provider, whether a revocation would be warranted, whether a temporary immediate suspension, because there appears to be an imminent need to affecting the safety of the children, so we would temporarily shut the child care center, a family child care provider, until we have looked into it. So there are key things that we do post for family providers, but that likely core work of the correction orders we are not posting, and we will need to do that. And so we've been developing an electronic compliance tool that both state licensors as well as county licensors can use, so that we can have a database that we are able to then meet our posting requirements. At the same time that we're trying to do that, it also gives us the opportunity to rethink, one, how we're currently putting information up, what the block grant requires. The block grant does require, the federal reauthorization does require, that inspection and monitoring results be posted for a minimum of 3 years. It's also very clear that you cannot post sort of legalese, very legally jargony letters, that they want plain language. So either the document that's being put up would need to be plain language and rewritten, or if it is going to be some sort of a correction order that is very, you know, appeal rights and statutory references, that there would need to be a plain language summary. Anybody that has seen our licensing information, look up in our correction orders, and Ms. Cunningham in her statements is correct that those are not plain language. They are very much of a legal document that triggers, you know, appeal rights for the individual provider to challenge either our decision or the county's. So we know that we need to do some additional work in revamping our posting website, and we have heard from Ms. Cunningham and others as we do that. We think the ability to get the data from the counties is going to help us a great deal in looking at consistency and looking at training requirements for licensors both at the county level as well as DHS. So what you have on the handout, just some information that we thought is we've been trying to look and understand some of our data and our trends might be helpful. We note on page 2 with a chart, this is for calendar year 15.
Ms. Lerner, before we continue on with page 2, Representative Albright has a question.
So I'm looking at page 4, which is on the actual back, and I'm looking at the, maybe skipping ahead, looking at the background studies, the last point on the bottom. And you mentioned about the counties and whatnot and the interaction and the support that you obviously are looking for from the counties. Have you gotten any sense from the counties in terms of the manpower that they're going to have to increase by FTE count just to do what is required or will be required under federal conformity? Have you gotten a sense for what the increase in their FTE count is going to be?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I think based on some survey work that we had done over the past year, it's an estimate of about 50 to 60 for county licensors.
Madam Chair, is that based upon a density of population or like you're saying about a caseload? I mean, how do they come up with that number?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I don't know that I can adequately explain how they come up with it. We tried to get a sense of, you know, sort of who's already doing off-year inspections because what they look for may not need to change very much. So if they're already staffed and doing it, I will say as background information that currently there is no direct funding that goes to the counties for licensing activities that they are responsible for. So the back page, it does indicate in the so I'll move very quickly to the story and not have Representative Albright steal my thunder anymore. But I wanted to give you all a little bit of a context before we just put the numbers out there, because the numbers will be big. There's no way to get around that. When we've looked at some other states that have been on very high caseloads and or less frequent inspections, their numbers are very high. So part of what I can tell you is for Michigan in 2015, they appropriated $5.7 million for 39 additional licensors to help them come into compliance with the block grant. And it reduced their caseload average from 150 to 98. In Colorado, this was just before reauthorization took effect. They were trying to reduce their inspection time from 24 months down to 18 months. And they appropriated $1.3 million for an additional 20 staff, and they were trying to bring their caseloads down from 145 per licensor down to 100. So we, as I mentioned in January 11th, we are one of fewer than 10 states that does not do annual inspections. There are many other states that are clearly doing annual inspections. Some are mandated to do even more than one unannounced inspection a year. And for us, this is sort of the biggest lift for licensing is to conform our staffing to do that and to get our caseloads down. So if you look at the previous information, which you can certainly look at, tries to give you a sense of the work that we do, the range of it, the extent of it. We looked at fiscal year 15 because licensing is more than just going out and doing the visit. Licensing is helping with the applicant. It's getting a lot of technical assistance through. We do that. The county staff do that. We are responding to complaints that come in, and those would get priority over a regular inspection, especially with limited staff, because if there's an allegation that somebody is violating and the health and safety could be immediately affected, that is a priority for us, and we don't want to just keep putting the sort of provider, the good provider that we're not hearing about off the radar. But, again, it's limited resources, and we need to make certain that kids are cared for. Well, so that's a place that we have focused our resources, and that does take away from being able to meet the two-year reviews.
I have a question for you.
How many of the other 10 states don't have don't do annual inspections already have a state-supervised system instead of county-administered?
Madam Chair, just so I understand, so of the states that are not doing annual inspections, how many of them are county delegated or how many are not county delegated?
So I'm wondering, are they state administered through those or is it county?
Madam Chair, committee members, I can look into that a little bit more and find out. I'm not as familiar always with how their child care system. They might have parts of their human services, like California, for one. It's very county-based administration of human services. I don't know for sure if their licensing is. I know that they were one that I believe was on a five-year inspection cycle. But we could try to find that information out for you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So,
Representative Albright.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So, kind of playing ping-pong catch-up here. So, we talk about In that same point, you're going to have to conduct 100,000 background studies between 2018 and 2020.
Yep.
So, sorry if I'm stealing your thunder.
No.
But it's three. It's a multi-pronged question. What's the split between those background checks that occur at the county level and the state level? B, give me a range in terms of what a background study costs. I mean, where is that baked into the budget in terms of an assessment, in terms of how much is it going to cost per study? Mm-hmm. And then fingerprinting, obviously that's a cost that's incurred by the provider themselves. So can you give me an idea in terms of what fingerprinting costs these days? Is it gratis if you go to the local law enforcement agency or not? And obviously, you know, I think there's an encumbrance upon the provider that they've got to take maybe half a day off to go and get that. And so I'm wondering, as you roll into the 2018-2020 period, are you saying that everybody, regardless of, let's say that they just had their fingerprints done in December of 2017, that now they're going to have to do it again, maybe just 2 months later? Or is it on a rolling basis based upon almost like a grandfathering of, well, you just had it 6 months ago, so you're good to go, and we won't catch up with you until, say, 2019, as opposed to just 2 months later when they've already incurred the cost, which they thought was going to last a year. So, Madam Chair.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Albright, members of the committee, those are very good questions, and we'll flesh out the background study. So currently, the background study for child care centers is done through DHS. We have a system that we're developing and had for a while in that study, and we're transforming it into a fingerprint-based as opposed to name and date of birth. The counties for licensed family child care providers, the county had been is responsible under statute for doing those background studies, and I believe that they can charge up to $100 for the kind of 2 year cycle of that application for the background study. Our legislative proposal would be to transfer the authority for background studies from the county to DHS because of the new requirements to meet. It isn't just the FBI fingerprint check, although that's a big part, but there's also looking at other state abuse and neglect registries on where somebody has lived in the last 5 years. It's looking at sex offender registries at the national level and in other states. So as there are more requirements added on, it seemed as though we would clearly need to be moving our system and that it would make sense to just have that work transferred to DHS. And so that is built in there. The reauthorization requires this new enhanced study once every 5 years. If a state has the ability to do what some people refer to as sort of a wrap back or a continuous update, then the feds could approve your system and say, great, one and done. You don't need to redo it. But the way it's written, and there isn't a lot of states that are able to do the kind of continuous loop wrap back of information, partly because the FBI hasn't quite gotten there. So you would need to do it once every 5 years. The specific reference to the 100,000 and where we will have a pain point and need some FTEs, and I think if you drill into the budget pages, you'll see the FTEs for background studies drop off after the first 3 years, because we will need to have every existing person who is currently working and has had a study done under our other, you know, name and date of birth, get one of the new enhanced studies. So that isn't going to be pleasant for us to tell people, but they will have to do that. And so that's where that figure of 100,000 comes in, because it's trying to manage. We are looking at potentially a rolling basis of providers so that we can ensure that there's going to be adequate access at fingerprint stations that we have across the state, and not just kind of open the spigot and, you know, have somebody within the first couple of months. So we are looking at how to stage out the background study requirement. And I think for family child care providers on that two-year renewal cycle, then that's when that would hit them. We're concerned about the deadlines and compliance, but, you know, we can only do what we can do, and this will be a big undertaking. You asked a little bit about the range and the cost. For the actual cost of fingerprinting, it's approximately $9 and some change, so a $9 to $10 figure to do that actual transaction. Then there is the cost to do the actual study. And currently the way our system is set up, the vendor that is that we have contracted with that does the actual live scan submission of the fingerprint does not do anything with the study. They don't get paid. They just transmit. I mean, they get paid, you know, through their contract. But the transactional piece does not involve the payment at the site. So whether that's the provider doing that, whether that's the individual, there is, a fixed cost in there. The rest of the cost of the study, with these enhanced registries that we would need to check and sending it on and looking for where people have lived in the last 5 years across the board, which is a little bit different than what we would currently do now, I believe we are estimating, and I don't know, yeah, 40? Yeah, we're very mindful of the added cost. Generally, it's a $20 background study under our what had been our name and date of birth and our fingerprint base that we're moving to now. But these added registry checks are going to require more. We're also going to be needing to respond timely to requests coming in from other states. The federal reauthorization law says that the background studies are to be completed within 45 days. I think that we are trying to look at some models in other states where they may be granting some sort of a provisional approval. We're very aware of the concerns. We share them with regards to access and workforce issues, so we're trying to sort of manage that. But the cost for this study would be higher than what a current background study is, and we hope our system is already being developed and is trying to get as quickly as we can to a place of wrap back, where they wouldn't need to take it, they wouldn't need to repeat the study once every 5 years.
So, if I'm clear then by what you just explained, the number of FTEs that you will need to perform that function are included in the budget numbers that you've submitted to us.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, yes.
Okay.
And so just to very quickly touch upon the last page there where we try to scope out where we tried to group this, what we thought might be four buckets to help the committee understand. So licensed child care centers, that would be our DHS staff, to oversee the annual, to complete the annual inspections, as well as to develop our, you know, our triage response, 20.5 FTEs. The next one, regarding family child care, So what we are proposing here is twofold. One is additional staff, and then the other you'll see is the governor has included an appropriation for grants to the counties to assist in offsetting some of that cost. I would like to say that part of what we are looking at in our FTE request for family child care to oversee the county is we have known since the block grant came with the annual inspections that our work with the counties was going to look different, and we had been engaging them saying, you know, we now all have to meet this. It's not a wishful thing. We could be at risk of corrective actions or penalties if we're not meeting both the annual inspections as well as the posting requirement. We also have heard very consistently, and as I said through many of the subcommittee and select committee hearings across the state, real concerns about our ability to oversee the county, consistency among county licensors. Our staffing does not allow us to do any significant level of, you know, immediate day-to-day oversight. First of all, it's not our role. That's the county supervisor's role. But we have had, both with family child care and child foster care, very limited staff. Section 245A.16, that's the Human Services Licensing Act, and that provision governs some of our delegated licensing authority. And that requires us to monitor the counties for compliance with all of the licensing, not just family child care that they do, once every 4 years. So our oversight is in statute once every 4 years. What we have been doing as part of this block grant, as we've looked at what other states are doing and trying to sort of advance and reform our system at the same time we're trying to come into compliance, we actually have had a couple of good conversations with the state of Ohio. The state of Ohio is a county-based licensing system. They, prior to the block grant, so they had already done this, had been dealing with what we believed were some of the same things as they expressed it. A county-based system for some of their family child care providers, a lot of concerns and questions about consistency, complaints from providers, complaints from, you know, legislators, from advocates, and they instituted a model that we think is a very good model. They've told us that in the first 18 months, they feel that they have made a great deal of progress in gaining consistency and addressing that relationship between the county licensor and the provider. It is modeled, quite honestly, like our delegated system. The counties do the work. They engage the state staff for the application for significant sanctions like a conditional or revocation. The difference is, however, that they have staffed one state staff person. They've created a unit so that they can break their counties up, and each state person has about 15 to 18 counties, and they go out and do an annual observation of each licensor that is within their county mix and give them feedback. They do a file audit of each of the licensors once a year. We, you know, think that that is a very good model. We've, like I said, had some conversations. We think that that is a way for us to approach our compliance and also help us to gain the consistency. We are very aware of providers having real concerns about the posting of correction orders. Some of our FTE, when you look at that division-wide count, tries to put in some staff there to give us both some data policy component. We think that our compliance database is going to allow us to really be able to target where training is needed, not just for providers, but also for county licensors. It tries to also acknowledge the likely increase in reconsideration requests and appeals that we will get with the posting of correction orders. I think it is very understandable that folks who maybe kind of looked at something and disagreed with it but might not have pursued it will certainly view that differently if something is going to be posted up on the website. What we're trying to do is we look at the posting requirements, and I'm trying to acknowledge Ms. Cunningham's comments. We have heard this from others. We're trying to understand that what the final rule, which came out in late September, says. We know that a substantiated report has to be up there for 3 years. We're trying to understand where we might have some flexibility about, do we post it as soon as it's issued? Do we wait until the appeal time runs? I mean, we're trying to rethink how we normally just put public information up, and we want to be engaging providers in that. Our licensing information lookup page will look different than it does now for child care providers, absolutely. So that...
Well, I do have a question. So as we're talking about the child care, I just want to remind the body that the child care on the licensed home front, that they're small business owners and primarily women business owners who right now are feeling like they are being regulated out of existence. As we've heard all across the state during our task force. And I feel that the, you know, there's some great requirements, there's some great ideas from this block grant here, but, you know, the providers that we're talking to feel like this is yet another attack on their business. And I'm just wondering, has there been any numbers thrown out about what providers currently are paying and what they will have to pay on top of the FBI checks, more training, and then if there is any indication whether or not local property taxes will be going up if the state doesn't adequately fund?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the governor's budget request does not increase any licensing fees for either family child care providers or for centers. We heard very clearly from the counties who license those in-home family providers in particular that that was not an option that they wanted to see the state pursue. We did a quick survey of some of our own state center fees, our application fees, and our renewal fees, and what we found is that we're a little bit below average of the 20 states we informally surveyed on our application fee. It's a flat 500 fee. Many states for their centers have a tiered, the more your capacity is, the higher your application fee is. We just have a flat fee. But when we looked at the renewal license fees, what we found, without even contemplating these changes, is that we're in these 20 states we looked at, on average, you know, a couple hundred dollars above. Often your renewal fee is tiered based on your capacity. So what that told us is we already think that the provider community is paying a significant amount towards the licensing cost. Is that an option to go further? That's an option for the legislature. We looked at where that where there was movement for that, and both from our look at it and from the county input, we did not see trying to increase provider license fees as a solution to this. And so our FTE request, you know, does not reflect any increase in fees. Madam Chair, to your question about the local property taxes and the impact, I would not be able to comment on that. As I said, the governor's budget does try to acknowledge that there are some additional costs to the counties and looking at funding a grant to help offset that. I don't think anybody would say that we are confident that that would take away all of their increased costs, but we certainly are aware that for some counties, they too will need to do more to ensure that they can do annual inspections.
Yeah. Go ahead and continue.
Generally, that's concludes my remarks. I mean, I think, you know, Ms. Barrico allowed me to have the luxury of going second so that I could talk about my FTE request at the latest possible time, despite all of your best efforts to lead me there much quicker. but we just thought that giving you a little bit more context about, you know, the nature of our work, the nature of the county's work, both what it is now and how we really are trying to use implementation of the new federal requirements as a way to not just technically come into compliance, because we can do that, but we want to do this in a way that builds in what we know we've been hearing very clearly in the last year or two. And we know that this posting requirement, although it can sound sort of like, oh, it's just technology, just put something up there, we've been looking at what a lot of other states do. Some of them portray their information in a way that is far more useful for both providers as well as families. We think that there's a lot that we can be moving to in that direction to really meet not just the letter but the spirit. There is a very big emphasis in the reauthorization around consumer-friendly, accessible information, both for family making the choice, what type of provider, how do I determine if that's the right fit for me, as well as how do I get access to a compliance history? How do I make sure I know what has been going on there? So we're trying to take what we've currently been doing with our posting, meet the federal requirement to get the county posting in, and then be very aware of the impact, as we always do, of what our public information has on the provider community.
Representative Stanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, now I have a question that I will go back to. I just didn't want to interrupt you before. If you go back to the parent aware document that we were looking at, in the very first paragraph, it talks about redefining quality, and it makes the statement, you know, that too many children in Minnesota aren't prepared for kindergarten. And I'm just curious, what is the data source that they're using to make that statement by? If you don't have the answer, certainly if you can follow up on that. And what are the criteria? Because I'm just a little cautious that that's becoming a phrase that's more of a buzzword than maybe grounded in factual data.
Madam Chair, Representative Nikki Farago from the Department of Human Services. I don't have that with me, but I appreciate the question, and we'll be happy to follow up with you on that.
Great. Thanks much.
Members have any other questions? All right. I'm just going to ask a question to the department. I am wondering if you have any idea what the major contributing factor for the loss of child care providers in our state, if you have an idea what's contributing to our access issues.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think one of the shortcomings that we have really come to learn and are trying to figure out how we move beyond is how we do get better information about why providers are leaving. The chart that you have on our licensing fact sheet at page 2 does just give you the data point about a significant number of closures of licenses, both for centers and family providers, within the first 4 years. And, you know, that was very interesting. It's the first time we really just kind of said, okay, we know how many are closing, but why don't we figure out how long had they been open? And what we saw was, you know, within that first 4 years.
Ms. Wagner, could you point us
sorry.
To?
There's yes. so many pieces of paper
that's
in front
fine,
of us.
Yes. This one right here that says key health and safety requirements. It's a 4-page document. It had my FTE count on the last page, in case it's all highlighted by now. And on page 2 is a chart from Licensing Information Database that looks at, in fiscal year 2015, when we closed a license, how long had that license been open? And, you know, again, we're probably in a wash in a sea of data, and we've got to start using it better to both inform the questions and help move us towards some answers. And so what this shows us, particularly that darker band, is the family child care providers. But, you know, centers are not necessarily all that far behind. Now, this includes a range of reasons for the closure. We don't break that out. So it could be somebody voluntarily leaving. It could be us revoking somebody, right? So not all closures are equal, and we can kind of keep teasing this out. But to the extent that there are any compliance issues, getting technical assistance, you know, we view correction orders, and I'm happy to have the providers disagree. They do all the time, but we view correction orders as a very important tool to helping that provider stay on track, get on track, be in compliance. And if we can have licensors that are out there, you know, very well trained and giving them that guidance and keeping that kind of smooth sailing so it doesn't reach the point of any sort of a crisis or a critical need to take an action, that would be important. Informally, we know that a few counties have surveyed some of their providers when they have closed, kind of done almost like an exit survey. And I think what we find is that, in general, some of the same things we hear across the country. This is not unique to Minnesota, the closure and leaving the child care provider field. It can be because it was temporary. My children are young. I would like to do some child care while I'm home with them. I've just moved to an area. I don't know the work experience yet, so I'm going to do something here. It could be that somebody was in the down economy, might be laid off. This might be a place for them temporarily to supplement family income, as well as really engage in, for a lot of them, their previous educational and professional background. You know, oftentimes it is within a child educational setting. We hear regulation is a piece of that, and we do our best to understand, which ones and why. I can't say that we feel confident that all of these closures are related to regulation. We think that there is a mix in there as to why people are choosing to leave. But to the extent that we can identify places in the regulations that we need to either rethink, we are certainly open to doing that if there are access issues, but knowing that health and safety is paramount. And so if a regulatory structure is creating a pressure on a provider, somewhere we've got to find that balance of keeping that provider in compliance and engaged and not having the process feel too onerous. I will say in 2013 we made some changes legislatively and policy related to safe infant sleep practices because we had had a spike in deaths, mainly in family child care, a few in centers, and we did public education campaigns around that. We had a lot of media around it. We enhanced some of the training and really targeted because many of the deaths in family child care, 75%, had a safe sleep violation associated at the time of the death. And so for us, that correlation may not have been causation, but that correlation was very large. And we're very happy to say that since 2013, the number of deaths in family child care has dropped and has remained. One is tragic, absolutely, but it has been one, two, maybe only three. We had, an average of 8 to 10 a year, and that just wasn't acceptable. So do the safe sleep requirements impact and ask a provider to do more? Yes. Do we think that they have been a piece of helping to address that very disturbing trend of deaths in licensed settings? Absolutely. So I think that's part of what we are constantly struggling with and trying to balance.
So are county licensors also required to take the training required of child care providers? Do they have an idea of exactly what goes on?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, county licensors are required to be trained in the rule and statutes, and our office does provide some targeted training in those areas.
But they don't actually take the same courses just to have an idea of what those providers are learning?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I really couldn't speak for what an individual licensor, may or may not do. There certainly are different trainings available and even web-based trainings, but our office does work with counties to provide training to the licensors in these areas.
Okay. Vice Chair Peterson.
I was just curious, because it seems like there's quite a few different inspectors from different departments, like Department of Health to the county to the state. Has there ever been a look at maybe looking at one agency to oversee all these different components to sort of help streamline the compliance piece?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think in general that is a topic that has come up. It certainly has not come up with us as part of looking at reauthorization. I think that there are times when people look at the Department of Health and DHS licensing and think that there could be some efficiencies there. What we found, and there's actually a legislative report from, I think, 2013 that MMB did at the request of the legislature to look at DHS and MDH licensing, is that there's very little overlap in who we regulate and how we do it. So we are regulators, but our provider base really doesn't overlap. But I think we're always trying to look at where can our resources not be duplicative, and there may be some, you know, opportunities with, you know, food regulators that are out there. I mean, I certainly don't want to say that, you know, short of a wholesale integration that we can't try to figure something out. The block grant reauthorization does encourage states to look at, you know, is there somebody else that is basically doing that inspection and can meet that requirement for you, and do you need to look at, you know, interagency agreements, memorandum of understanding. We didn't see that infrastructure currently in place as an immediate way to help us meet the compliance with the block grant annual inspections, but it is something that I think we want to keep looking at. We're very cognizant of, weren't you just here? Well, no, that wasn't us. I mean, and that happens a lot. And so we're, you know, constantly trying to figure out, can we do it differently and not have it seem as kind of intrusive for the provider?
Madam Chair, yeah, I agree. I don't think that there's overlap of the scope, but that's how the providers feel, because when they're having a visit, it's taking their time, and that's what I think has been more of the problem. It's not so much that, yes, I know you need to check these certain different areas, but if one person could check all those areas, just like you expect the person to comply with all those different areas, I think it might be less problematic for the provider. And then the second piece is, you know, as you move to this fingerprint database, you know, do you have policies in place to destroy that information after these centers close or as they change, or what happens with that data?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, members of the committee, we do not retain any of the actual fingerprint. Even with the system that we have been, you know, we had legislative approval for in 2013 to begin going to a state-level check at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, fingerprint-based, and our system is designed, we do not retain those.
All right. Representative Cable.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Wagner, do you have any information on how the closure of licensed child care centers compares to other service industry or similar industries, or is child care kind of an outlier?
Madam Chair, Representative Cagle, I don't have that in front of me. We are trying to replicate this across our other service areas. At the Department of Human Services, we also do adult day centers, chemical dependency treatment centers, some mental health, residential intensive treatment centers. So it's a place that we're trying to kind of build our capacity to use our data and understand and see what seems to be consistent. Is everybody getting into it, leaving within a five-year span, or are there some interesting trends only in certain service classes? So, you know, perhaps at some point I'll be able to follow up with you.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, child care is certainly definitely an issue. I'm hearing from employers all over the state that are having workforce issues because they're unable to get you know, employers there due to the fact that there is no child care for these people. We are going to take some public testimony, and we have to make public testimony, sadly, kind of fast because Representative Chair Davids needs to use this room at 10. First up, we have Claire Sanford with the Minnesota Child Care Association, and then we have two individuals from Catholic Charities, and I certainly do not want to mispronounce names, so. So we have about 3 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my name is Claire Sanford. I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association, and today I'm here representing the Kids Can't Wait Coalition. I appreciate you having me back. I was supposed to do this a couple weeks ago. Weather prevented me from getting here. If we don't live here for the weather, it must be because fine people like you run the place.
Thank you.
As we know, Minnesota is now over 2 years behind in implementing the Federal Child Care and Development Block Grant Reauthorization, which was landmark legislation passed at the federal level with overwhelming bipartisan support, really championed by Minnesota Congressman John Klein. Decades ago, CCAP, child care assistance, was seen as a work support only for families. This was before the explosion of neuroscience and economic research into the importance of the first several years of life. And while child care was and is still a critical economic support for parents, the program has evolved to reflect the incredibly important work of providers in terms of child development. health, safety, and quality provisions have increased. But most importantly, what we're going to talk about are these family-friendly stability policies you've been hearing about. Kids Can't Wait believes that at a minimum, we must proceed to implement these federal reforms in ways that do no harm to families currently on the program. And the first thing I'd like to talk about is the provider reimbursement rate. As you know, current rates are at the 25th percentile of 2011 market rates. We believe we must move to using the most recent market survey, which is a requirement in the federal reauthorization, and that this should be automatically updated every 2 years when the survey is done. The federal reauthorization also requires a no more than X number of years time of passage before rates are again pegged to current market rates. And it would be nice to have that automatic so we're not on the gerbil wheel of taking up your time every 2 years to get that done. We would like to be, the federal standards is the 75th percentile of market rate for reimbursement for access for families. I was pleased, Chair Franson, in your task force recommendations that there was discussion among task force members of going anywhere between the 25th percentile and the 75th percentile. At the very minimum, we want to stay at the 25th percentile where we are now, but use the most recent market rate survey. And then we've got to implement the family-friendly provisions of the reauthorization. They're good policy for kids, for families, and for providers. And what they do is provide certainty for families and children. We've heard a lot about the 12-month eligibility. That's one major piece so that families know, okay, at least for the next 12 months, I know I have child care. This is going to enable me to go to school, go to work, not have disruptions in that. Another change is stability in family copays. Representative Albright earlier mentioned when we were talking about rates, what it would be like to go to every gas station in the metro area and have a different price for gas. That would just be madness. And right now, family copays can change very frequently. If you work 2 more hours or you get a 10-cent raise per hour or something like that, and stability in copays for a year would also help families have some certainty in their family budgets. And we're talking about low-income families who are living paycheck to paycheck. The ability to budget for what their copays are going to be is very important. And finally, another major provision is consistent attendance, both for children in child care programs and their parents at work or school. The federal reauthorization provides allowances so that families don't lose their child care assistance for temporary breaks like a semester break at school if parents are going to college or time between jobs for parents. Parents will have the opportunity to have certainty that their children are in a stable setting so they can focus on what they need to do in terms of school or work and not have continuous disruptions. We need to stop treating children as parcels that can be moved around and bounced in and out of settings without consequence. And we can't pretend that parents are able to seek and maintain employment or schooling with consistent disruptions. And, of course, none of these new benefits are available to families languishing on wait lists in our state. In some counties, parents are told the wait is 2 years or more, and they have to remain out of the workforce or choose arrangements that are not acceptable or meet their family needs. And ideally, we'd like to see CCAP forecasted, but we know there are a lot of priorities going on this year, so our minimum recommendation, again, is to keep the 25th percentile but use the most recent market rate survey. So in closing, Kids Can't Wait urges the legislature to allow the family-friendly CCAP reforms to be implemented without serving fewer families, make an additional appropriation to take at least some more families off the wait list, and to increase provider reimbursement rates to the most recent market survey and automatically update them. Thank you very much for your time.
All right, thank you. Catholic Charities.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Akua Ellis. Yes, it's easier once you hear it and see it spelled. Akua Ellis, and I'm Director of Social Justice. Thank you. I'm the Director of Social Justice Advocacy at Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I promise I'll be brief. So at our Northside Child Development Center, which is located in North Minneapolis, we serve roughly 129 children on average, representing 90 families, and over 90% of those families receive child care assistance program funds. Northside provides high-quality child care and a 4-star parent-aware rated environment. We also offer valuable life resources and supports to parents as well. As a member of the Kids Can't Wait Coalition, We support increased funding for the CCAP Basic Sliding Fee Program to serve additional families under the program, as well as higher reimbursement rates for CCAP providers. We also support the family-friendly provisions of federal conformity. Two specific items of importance to us are the establishment of a 12-month eligibility redetermination period that will lessen the current disruption of services to CCAP families, and Claire really highlighted that very well, as well as the provision for a graduated phase-out of assistance for families whose incomes have increased during the time of redetermination. And this second provision is particularly of interest for us because it addresses the cliff effect, whereby the impact of increased family earnings does not sufficiently cover the loss of assistance at the time of redetermination. DeMont Jones, who runs the Northside Child Development Center, could not be here to join me today due to day job obligations, but I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. And thank you for the time and attention.
Thank you, Akua.
All right. Is there anyone else? Okay, does anybody else want to testify? No? All right, well, I want to thank you for this yet another productive meeting. Very overwhelming, actually. A lot of details, a lot of things to look at and consider as we move on. And we will meet again next Wednesday. Stay tuned for next week's agenda. I'm sure it'll be just as exciting as today's was. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.